Welcome to episode 463 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and today we have a Q&A episode with listener questions. And I think we have some really good questions. So as a reminder, if you are not aware, you can email me questions at any time, and I save them for the next Q&A episode that I do, which I try to do fairly regularly. I also post requests for questions in my Instagram stories on Scientific Triathlon HQ on Instagram. Please give me a follow there if you're not already following. And that's where usually in my stories, I will post a request a few days before I'm recording a Q&A episode. So that's a good reminder if you have anything on your mind that you can send in questions and get them answered on the podcast here. Before we dive into today's questions, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. Last week, I talked about how I love the drink mix for training because it has the lowest cost per gram of carbohydrate of all the Precision Fuel Hydration products. But today I want to talk about racing. What are my go-to products for racing? Put simply and shortly, because I don't want to make this long-winded, a flow gel on the bike is amazing, and combine that with some caffeine gels, so the 30-gram carbohydrate gels with 100 milligrams of caffeine. That's an amazing combo. That's nutrition-wise, and in the bottles, some bottles with water, some bottles with electrolytes to match your sweat sodium concentration, I should say. And on the run, I would again take a caffeine gel, maybe two if it's a full distance, for a half distance, just one. And I would add a couple of PF 30 gels if it's a half distance, so maybe get three or four gels total, including that caffeine gel of 30 grams each of carbohydrate. Or if it's a full distance, I would get a couple of 90-gram gels plus probably two caffeine gels of 30 grams of carbs each. And that would be, in a nutshell, my nutrition plan and the recommended the products that I use. I love the caffeine gels for racing. They're great. And the flow gel is amazing on the bike as well. Super practical. It packs a lot of carbohydrates in a relatively small package, and it is easy to consume. You can get 15% off your first order of 2025 by using the code TTS25 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get started with our first question for today. So the first question for today is from Alexis, who writes, how to get as fast as possible over the middle distance as a 19-year-old? Should I focus on the Olympic distance first? So thank you for your question, Alexis. That's a really great question. I don't think you necessarily have to focus on Olympic distance first. You might, in fact, be best served by focusing on middle distance straight away, unless you are actually really good at the Olympic distance and can, you know, get involved with your national federation or some good squads in your country and get some benefits that way. Just in terms of, imagine if you're doing this on your own and you don't have any outside support in that way from a federation or a good club, then I would say that go ahead and focus on middle distance straight away. However, you need to take a long-term view of your athletic development, which in my opinion means that you need to maximize your speed in the earlier parts of your career. So right now, you can maximize endurance later when you've reached the peak of the speed that you can possibly achieve. So in that sense, your training might look very, very similar to the training of somebody focusing on sprint and Olympic distance racing. Right now, that is how I would train. You can still race middle distance. You can do short, specific blocks of more endurance-focused work and middle distance-specific work into your key races. But I would be careful not to let this type of training take over your entire year. And I would be careful to not fall into the trap of wanting to do more and more volume and focusing too much on endurance, too much on the specific powers and paces that you want to do over middle distance at the expense of improving your top end. Because you won't reach your peak performance right now. You will reach your peak performance maybe 10 years from now, and that peak will be higher if right now you work more on your speed. Another thing that is really important and that I would really, really focus on right now is technique. Technique also gets harder and harder to improve as you get older. Technique applies especially to swimming, of course, so working on technique is the most important in swimming. But it also applies to cycling, for sure, definitely when we talk about more technical bike courses, and even to running to some extent. So that's another key focus that I would make a priority. Analyze where you are right now, see where you have room to improve, and work on that technique. Work on it consistently with focus, with discipline, and you'll thank yourself 10 years from now for sure. You also need to make sustainability a top priority because, as I said, it's probably going to take you 10 years to reach your peak performance at middle distance. If you go all in right now over 10 years in that hypothetical scenario, I don't know if that is the case. But regardless of how big your focus is, how big your commitment is, it needs to be sustainable for whatever level of commitment you have. While you need to work hard and not just do things that you like doing, you also cannot, you know, always have training feel like a drag. It has to be enjoyable. So think about what makes training enjoyable for you. And for a lot of people, I would say that a simple solution is to have some training partners, have some training groups. It doesn't have to be for all of your training, of course, but for some of your training, that can be a key to making the training sustainable and enjoyable. There are other things for sure that you could consider, like how does where you bike, where you run, where you swim play into your environment, simply? How does environment play into your sustainability? But also, this goes back to that question of not doing too much endurance-focused work. If you are focusing on maximizing speed, you will be doing a fair amount of training, of course, like the top sprint and Olympic distance athletes your age, they do train a good amount of hours, but not as many hours as the top middle distance athletes that are 30 years old. So keeping that slightly lower volume, relatively speaking, is something that can also help with sustainability. But that also doesn't mean, of course, intensity plays a part in that as well. Not doing too much intensity, getting injured all the time, which leads me to that next very important point, injury prevention. Preventing injuries, but also preventing overtraining are very important considerations because consistency is going to be key for you to reach your potential. If you don't have one, I'd say find a really good physio that you trust and that you can go and see every once in a while, even when you're healthy. If you stay healthy by getting a look over a couple times a year, two, three, four times a year, you'll save a lot of money compared to how much you end up spending if you do get injured and how to go in a lot more often. And of course, it's not just about the money, but it's about actually you being healthy and being able to train consistently. And in that way, have a better chance of reaching your potential. And regarding overtraining, I mentioned some of the points already about sustainability, which is also mental, not just physical. But of course, the basics, focusing on eating and sleeping well. And this is not necessarily something that you need any support to do. You might be able to do it fantastically without any support. But if you feel like you're not 100% sure about what you're doing when it comes to nutrition is right, then a good registered dietitian can be invaluable, even if it's just having a one-off consultation to get a look over of what you're currently doing and getting some feedback on if that makes sense or if there are some areas for improvement there. And the final point is get a coach. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that 99% of people need a good coach if they want to get as fast as possible, meaning they want to reach their potential. It doesn't mean that you can't get very good without a coach, because a lot of people can. But if you want to reach your potential or as close as possible to your potential, then you will absolutely need a good coach on your team, maybe more than one. So for example, a main triathlon coach and a swim coach. So that's definitely something that I would look for and do it sooner rather than later, because that's going to have a compounding effect on your career progression. So good luck, be patient and play the long game and enjoy your training. And I'm sure that you will do great. Question number two for today is from Bruna, who has two questions. So we'll start with part one, which is, what are your preferred ways to quantify training load? So thank you, Bruna, for your question. I'll start with a very simple scenario, which is, if we're talking a pure cyclist, I would use kilojoules as my number one way to quantify training load. Of course, it's important to point out that kilojoules here, the number of kilojoules that one person can sustain versus the other is not necessarily the same. So it's not a training metric that you can necessarily compare between two individuals, but for within one individual, so intra-individually as opposed to inter-individually, kilojoules is a fantastic metric. It also shows, of course, whether one person objectively is doing more training load than another person. but it doesn't deal with the question of whether you're like, what is the right load? Are you responding to it? Because you should only do the load that you can actually adapt to, which is the second part. But I guess we'll get to that a bit later in this question. But I just wanted to make the point there that the goal isn't to do the most amount of kilojoules possible, because somebody with a 200 watt FTP will almost never be able to do as many kilojoules as somebody with a 300 watt FTP, and they shouldn't. They should train for where they are at and not maybe where they want to go. But if we bring it back to triathlon, we cannot really measure kilojoules in running or in swimming. There are other load metrics that have been developed to work across sports, and sadly, they don't work across sports. TSS, training stress scores, and similar metrics, they cannot accurately capture load in this way. I'll get into that a bit later. So what I use is a simple metric that is simplistic, but it works. It's hours of training. So basically, how many hours do you train in a week, in a month, in a year, in a quadrennial? Okay, I probably don't look at it from a quadrennial cycle, but for sure in terms of the yearly training hours. That being said, there are definitely some limitations of this method, because a 10-hour training week, for example, of completely 100% zone 1, zone 2 endurance training is very different from a 10-hour training week in a high-intensity training block. But the reason that I don't see this as a too big of a limitation is that in my coaching, I tend not to have weeks that are too extreme one way or the other, neither fully packed with intensity nor just easy endurance training. It can happen occasionally. The weeks coming back after a season break, especially if it was a longer season break, might be, or they are certainly lighter on intensity, and in some cases might be completely without intensity. But pretty quickly, we get into a rhythm and balance of endurance work and intensity work. And although the specifics of the intensity in the workouts changes, so they generally still fall in a pretty narrow range in how hard they are for the athlete perceptually. So for example, you might do a threshold workout versus a race-specific 17.3 workout versus even a VO2 max workout. And in all of those workouts, there's not too big of a difference in how hard the athlete feel the workout is. Okay, the VO2 max workout, it probably feels a bit harder. It does. But it's not an order of magnitude harder, if that makes sense. It's a step up. But then all the other types of workouts that the athletes tend to do, they're pretty close to each other in terms of the how much you have left in the tank at the end. So you can compare a threshold workout and even an Ironman-specific workout in this way from a session RPE perspective. So basically what that means is that the intensity done in a week and the load of that intensity scales with the volume. So if we go from 10-hour training weeks to 12-hour training weeks, generally the intensity scales in the same way as the volume does. And this means that I can simply use training hours as a measure of load. And importantly, here I need to point out that this is training hours just from swimming, biking, and running. I exclude all other hours here, like strength training, hiking, and anything else that you might be doing, because I think that then, well, strength training as an example deals with a very different type of physiology, so I don't want to mix that in with the aerobic training load that we're discussing here when we're discussing the endurance training. So as a bit of a sidebar here about the reasons why training stress score, in my opinion, doesn't work, I know I discussed this before, so I'll try to be brief. But number one is that it hugely overestimates the training load from swimming, because a lot of swimming happens relatively close to threshold speed without being all that hard. Also, in swimming, any kind of tools that you use throws the validity of the calculation out the window. Because if you take on a pair of paddles and you suddenly swim faster than your threshold speed, but for an endurance effort, which is not uncommon, then obviously you're going to get a very grossly overestimated amount of training stress score from that type of swimming. And we use tools in swimming, so we cannot ignore this fact. Number two, training stress score can't account for terrain well when running. With running power, it can work okay with hills when you're on a road, a paved road. But on trails, for example, it's just not good. It just underestimates how hard a run is. So I would say that a heart rate TSS is a lot better there, but But again, I come back to like the simple metrics like hours as something that works better in combination with RPE, of course, but that's not part of the load metric per se. The third reason of FortiSS not working is that if you look back at your data, 80% of athletes, not all, but 80% of athletes will have fairly regular device failures or missing data or poor calibrations, all sorts of data collection issues, and these all result in huge sources of error. So when you take something that is like presented as being a very precise metric, and then you have these huge sources of error that I as a coach see every day happen to some athletes, like there's something that would lead to the TSS not being accurate or being missing or being counted, like double counted. All of these things happen regularly. And you could be like basically spend all your day cleaning up data. That's not effective use of time or mental capacity. I think a metric that has those kind of data collection flaws is just flawed. So that's another reason. And with ours, you do have some of that. You can have like lost data. You forgot to turn on your Garmin. But then you can just simply put in 1 hour in Training Peaks that you did a 1 hour run. You don't have the pace, you don't have the heart rate, but you have the hour. That's very simple to do. So so with ours, it's super easy to correct these data collection issues that you cannot really correct with Training Stress Score. And the fourth one is, and this is not a fault of the metric in itself, to be fair, but it's a problem that results from the metric that I think that a lot of athletes, they go too hard on their endurance runs and rides because they're actually thinking that they're going to get a higher TSS from their endurance work, and that that means that they're getting more fitness and more adaptation, which is not the case. So I think that, it's just TSS has been marketed in a way that has led to very kind of flawed training principles almost. And I'm a bit anti-TSS for this reason, it's fair to say, but I think that I have very like rational reasons for why I'm not using it, and I think that it's not a good metric that I laid out here. So in summary, I use hours, which I know some people think is backwards and simplistic, but for me, the simplicity is a big part of the strength of this method. It's pretty foolproof. It's hard to make it fail. It's also important to say that load, no matter which metric we use to measure load, doesn't really mean anything without response to load. So that's the original discussion there with the kilojoules example of somebody with 200 watt FTP versus 300 watt FTP. The 300 watt FTP rider is always going to get more kilojoules if they train like a roughly similar amount of hours, but that doesn't mean that they're doing that their load relative to their strength is higher. So what I think is more important to track than to track load is the response to the load that the athlete is under. And that's a bit beyond the scope of this question, but we'll get into like that kind of in Bruno's second part of the question or second question. But just briefly, I can say that the two most important ways that I use for monitoring response to load are, number one, subjective feedback from the athlete. So comments that, like, I feel fatigued versus I feel great. And two, cross-referencing or triangulating an external metric of intensity like pace or power versus an internal metric of intensity like heart rate or lactate versus RPE, which is, I would say, a holistic metric that encompasses a lot of things, like encompasses muscle fatigue and central fatigue and motivation, mood, all those sorts of things. So, for example, if you do environmental conditions, I should say some other aspects as well. So, for example, if you do a workout where your external metric, let's use power here, your power is fixed week to week, and your heart rate, which is your internal metric of intensity, is going down over consecutive weeks for that fixed power, this might mean several different things. But if it coincides with RPE being, let's say, stable or even decreasing, so the effort level is getting easier over the weeks, then this is a good sign of probably increased fitness. But if you have the same fixed power, the same drop in heart rate, but you have an increase in RPE over those weeks, then this is a sign of overreaching, fatigue, and that can be the right thing to do. It does happen, and it's not wrong for shorter periods. It can be what you're after, but you need to monitor this and not let it go on for too long, or the magnitude of it to get too big, essentially. So response to load, I think, is like actually a better question to look at, or a more important thing to monitor than the actual load, because load, it can change even within one person from 1 month to the other based on so many other factors like outside stressors and so on. What is the right load? So yes, it's important to monitor it, but I think the response to the load is what you really want to make a high priority to figure out how do you know what your response to the load is. Okay, so Bruno's second question is, what metrics do you look at to track if an athlete is at risk of overtraining? So I already mentioned this in the response to load discussion before, but triangulating an external intensity measure like pace or power with an internal metric of intensity like heart rate or lactate and with RPE. So usually this would be, if you're on the bike, it would be power, heart rate, and RPE. If you're running, it would be pace, heart rate, and RPE. And swimming, it's a bit harder to do. I would just use pace and RPE mainly. But you can, of course, use heart rate. It's heart rate can work in swimming, but I find that it's still a little bit, you have to be careful with it, because if the heart rate monitor is not exactly well placed, you can get bad readings. So it's just a little bit less reliable. So I don't rely on it too much in swimming, to be fair, even though I think that it's a good and interesting metric to use, but approach it with some caution. Overtraining occurs after an extended period of overreaching, and normally we would see one or all of the following. So one, suppressed heart rate and lactate, if you measure lactate. B, increased RPE. And three, an inability to reach the same performance outputs, so power output or speed, pace, at higher intensities. And so those would be all, or especially if you have all of those, then that would be a marker of initially just like a bit of fatigue. And that can move into overreaching, non-functional overreaching, and eventually overtraining. So those are some of the objective data, the most important objective data that I would use to monitor this. But subjective data, as I mentioned, is also super important. Motivation and mood, I think, are very important, and they can easily go down, drop, get worse in the early stages of overtraining and or even overreaching. If you want to be super scientific about it, there's a good validated questionnaire, the Profile of Mood States, that you could use. But for me, that's not really something that I use. It's more about asking the athlete questions about their mood and motivation and reading it through the regular conversations that we have and even the text conversations or text messaging, text comments on workouts and so on. But just as important as these things that I do measure or monitor in terms of risk of overtraining or overreaching is what I don't measure or what I would be really careful with, at least. So number one here is sleep data. Sleep can go either way when you're in getting into that state of overreaching, eventually overtraining. The athlete might sleep more due to fatigue, or they might have problems with like waking up in the middle of the night, not being able to fall asleep, any number of issues. So I for sure think that it's important here to ask the athlete or ask yourself about your sleep and to identify sudden changes in your sleeping patterns, because that can absolutely be a factor, an indicator that something is up, that something is not right. I guess you could come up with a way to quantify this, but I just think that the most sleep data devices still are not super reliable. So I'm not really looking at objective data, but more so just looking into it in terms of asking the athlete about whether there are any changes to their sleep patterns in the grand scheme of things. And the second metric that I don't monitor really, because I don't find it helpful, is HRV. I'll start with an anecdote here, because I have suffered in the past from overtraining myself. And one thing that was noticeable was how incredibly stable throughout that period my HRV was. So having gone through that and seeing that it's not something that I put much stock into to detect overtraining. And that's obviously just an N equals one experience. So I wouldn't use that as my rationale for not using HRV. But it's actually what I find is that with well-trained athletes, at least, HRV changes very little based on training. So for example, an athlete might have a training day where they do 2 90-minute sessions, both very intense, let's say a 90-minute hard bike in the morning and a hard 90-minute run in the evening. And their HRV the following morning could be like just their baseline level, nothing changed. It's the same as the day before and the day after. And it could be the same as the HRV after that day could be the exact same as after a rest day with just a 30-minute easy spin or a nice walk outside. So HRV in well-trained athletes based on training is, to me, like very stable. But what often leads to pronounced changes in HRV are other factors like poor sleep, stress, alcohol consumption, and travel. Those are four. And there is some research also to back this up. Marco Altini was part of some published research that looked into this. And basically, HRV seems to change more in response to training in less well-trained athletes, in my experience, that I'm not exactly sure if the research backs that up, but that is my experience. But still, for something as important as overtraining, I wouldn't, regardless of the level of the athlete, I wouldn't rely on HRV as the metric to catch it, because I don't think it's really that sensitive to training status, actually, and training load. So yeah, that's it, basically, as a summary. Heart rate, RPE, performance output in terms of power and pace, those are the objective monitors to look at. And looking at subjective data like motivation and mood, and also sleep pattern changes, those are some of the more subjective data that I would look at and would be really important to look at. You could look into profile of mood states, that could be an interesting one as well. But yeah, in simple terms, that's it. So thank you for your questions, Bruno, and happy training. The next question is from Everett, who is asking, I will begin training for my first marathon and plan on running 3 to 4 times per week with 2 to 3 workouts on the bike for cross training. When I bike, would it be meaningful to incorporate higher cadence work to recruit fast twitch muscles, or slower cadence riding for strength, or best to just ride at a comfortable cadence? All right. Thank you very much, Everett. I hope your marathon training is going well so far. First, I want to start with a little correction that cycling at higher cadence does not actually recruit more fast twitch muscles than it's actually the other way around, that cycling at a lower cadence for a fixed power output leads to a higher torque, and that recruits more fast twitch fibers than cycling at a higher cadence, which results in a lower torque. But it is a common misconception, so absolutely, nothing strange there, having that understanding. And regardless, this is still a very relevant question. I would just reframe your high cadence options as, should I incorporate higher cadences to increase heart rate and cardiovascular stress of cycling? Because actually, heart rate during cycling for the same effort level is normally lower than for running. So you could argue that getting your heart rate up a bit more for like a fixed effort level of cycling, let's say zone 2, would be a better way to simulate zone 2 running in that example. So basically, the reframe of your question would be, should I incorporate higher cadences to increase heart rate and cardiovascular stress of cycling, or incorporate lower cadences for strength, or just ride at a comfortable cadence? Another argument, actually, just sorry for the back and forth here, but you could make the argument that higher cadences might make for slightly quicker recovery, less muscular fatigue accumulation, especially compared to low cadence options from your cycling, which could be good for your running. Then you're not carrying that leg fatigue, muscular fatigue, and you're able to run better. So basically here, my answer would be that lower cadence riding, I think, is unlikely to be useful for your marathon training. It could be detrimental if you get that kind of leg fatigue, muscle fatigue afterwards. So you're just running a little bit worse than you would have done otherwise. So I would definitely skip lower cadence work for in a marathon training block. I would incorporate high cadence cycling in one of your weekly rides a favorite session that I have is to keep your power fixed in the middle of zone two and do a 10-minute block that is 4 minutes at 95 RPM, 3 minutes at 100 RPM, 2 minutes at 105, and 1 minute at 110. And then take a couple of minutes easy at a choice cadence and then repeat that 10-minute high cadence block again 4 or 5 times. This session actually works really, really well in erg mode on the trainer. So that's how I like to do it. But it can, of course, be done outdoors on flat terrain. And yeah, the point of that session is, well, in cycling terms, obviously, training at different cadences is good. It helps you have a higher range of cadences, both at the low end and the high end. But just from a pure marathon perspective, it is what we talked about before. Potentially, it could save your legs compared for the same power output, for a fixed power output. But more importantly, I think that it raises your heart rate slightly. So you get slightly more cardiac output and the heart works slightly harder than it would otherwise for that same power output. So that's really the benefit for running that I see of a session like that. And of course, depending on what a comfortable cadence level is for you, you might change those cadence targets that I mentioned. If you're like super comfortable and you habitually do your races at more than 95 RPM, then of course you should start at a higher level. You could start at 100 or 105 RPM and increase from there. Or if you're habitually a very low cadence rider, you race at 70 or 75 RPM, maybe you start at 90 instead of 95. But I would encourage everybody to start at least 90, because I think that that's very much doable. But yeah, there is some adaptability in where you start that kind of cadence ladder. So there are, for the one or two other sessions that you will be doing, if you're doing two or three bikes, it depends a bit on what you want as well and what makes you, you know, enjoy it and not have the riding be take away from your mental capacity to focus on the riding. So let's say riding at a specific cadence, I don't think is important enough or valuable enough that I would spend any more mental energy on it. If you feel that it is a bit of an energy drain and you have to really use mental energy to do this. But if, on the other hand, you benefit from and you like having that extra focus and that makes riding more enjoyable and less of a grind to you, then you could try to use the one or two other rides in your weeks at basically to ride at a slightly higher than your most comfortable cadence. So basically, if you normally average 85 RPM, try to average 90 RPM and see if you can even build further over time, even if you're just doing like regular endurance riding in those rides. Make them regular endurance rides at a slightly higher cadence than your normal, most comfortable cadence. Again, I don't think this will make a big difference to your marathon. These are very marginal gains, but perhaps in terms of that muscle recovery and also perhaps in terms of the heart working slightly harder, your heart rate going up slightly. So it comes down to whether you want that extra objective focus, extra objective to focus on in your riding or not. It's absolutely not going to be a negative. Just if mentally for you it's totally fine, you enjoy it, it's definitely not going to be a negative for you, neither for your marathon nor your long-term cycling development to do those rides at a slightly higher cadence. But it's also a very marginal gain, I would say. And to be clear, the high cadence workout that I mentioned before is also a marginal gain. But so if you end up dreading doing that workout every week, then don't, just ride at your comfortable cadence. But that is a workout that I use with most of my athletes, probably. So it is a good workout even for beyond the marathon for your triathlon development, I would say. So to wrap this up, at the end of the day, while cycling is good cross-training for running and doing the riding you're proposing will definitely be a net positive for your marathon, absolutely, compared to doing just the four runs and nothing else. The impact of exactly what you do on the bike is going to be quite small, as long as it doesn't take away from your running, then it can be a negative impact. But the positive impact, whatever you do, is quite small. So the key thing really is the running and that the cycling doesn't take it out of you so that you underperform in your running. So good luck with your Marathon Everett, and I hope that this was helpful. Right, let's get into the final question for today. This is also a two-part question from Carl Erik, who asks, "Hi, I'm a big fan of your podcast and love listening to your episodes. I had a question concerning zone 2 cycling workouts. I've noticed that when I do long zone 2 workouts on my trainer, like 2.5 to 3 hours, my heart rate will start low for the first hour and 45 minutes to 2 hours, around 105 to 115 beats per minute, and then start creeping up to 125 to 135 beats per minute for the last 45 minutes to 1 hour. My FTP is 305 watts, and I do my zone 2 workouts at 190 watts in erg mode for these sessions. Why is this happening? Should I be changing my workouts, or will my body eventually adapt so that my heart rate stays more constant throughout the whole session? I would say that my RPE also increases slightly, at most by 1 point, but I'm still able to have a conversation in full sentences. I do drink a carbohydrate drink and have gels during my ride. All right, so thank you for your question, Carl-Erik. Also, I shortened this question a bit, but from the rest of your email, although I didn't include it here, I gather that your background is in running and that you're fairly new to triathlon and cycling. So with this in mind, what you're describing sounds like a pretty straightforward case of not having built up the durability yet on the bike to hold a steady heart rate for longer than about 2 hours. Durability is mostly related to chronic training volume, so lifetime training volume, really. And in your case, just continuing to train consistently, putting the hours on the bike, will gradually move the point of heart rate starting to drift further and further out, until you can do the full 3 hours and eventually even more than that at your steady heart rate without the drift that you're now seeing after about 2 hours. So no, just based on what you're describing here, there is no reason to change anything. Just stay consistent, be patient, keep working on it. That said, there are a couple of details that you could look into. I don't know enough from your question to say that there's anything like wrong with it, but I'm mentioning it here. You don't mention fans or any cooling in your post. So if you don't already have a fan, be sure to get a good fan or two for your indoor riding, because an increase in core temperature could also be the reason for your increased heart rate. And certainly if you don't have a fan, I would bet that this is at least part of the reason. And you can easily compare this if you go and do a ride outside for 3 hours where you ride outside, you fuel and hydrate the same way that you have been doing indoors. You ride at the same power for 3 hours, but outdoors, of course, you have more cooling compared to if you don't have a fan indoors. So see what happens to your heart rate there. Is there a difference? Regarding fueling and hydration, you said that you're drinking and eating during the ride, which is great, but what's not clear is exactly how much. So if you're taking 20 grams per hour of carbohydrate, that might be a reason, or if you're consuming 1 500 milliliter or 16 ounce bottle in the whole ride, then those could be reasons that you're like too low on your carb intake or your fluid intake. So I would say that you could, for a 3 hour solid zone 2 ride, definitely you could go to 60 grams an hour. It could be just sugar, water, the classic cheapest option for training rides. I would definitely try to get at least 60 grams an hour in and see if that changes things. But you could even try all the way up to 90 grams an hour and see how that affects things. And as for hydration, what I would do is simply assess your sweat loss from these rides. So weigh yourself before and after the ride in the nude, wipe off your sweat from your body before the post-ride weigh-in, and also weigh your bottles before and after the ride. That way you can check how much fluid you actually consume. But basically, for a ride like this, a 3 hour endurance ride indoors, I would say that there's not really any reason not to consume enough fluid, that your sweat loss should be more than 2, at most 2.5% of your body weight. If you lose more than 2.5% of your body weight, you can now calculate how much more fluid you should consume next time to stay within that limit. Because if you're above that, let's say you're losing 3% or more of your body weight, Then I would expect this to manifest in an increase in heart rate because of purely dehydration. That's not to say that it couldn't have an effect already at losing 1 to 2% of your body weight, or 1 to 2% dehydration, that is. But all of that being said, the most likely and probably the biggest contributing factor is simply that this is where your durability on the bike is at the moment, and the way to work on it and improve it is just continuing with a consistent volume over time and good quality training, of course. But volume over time is really the main factor and what will help you improve this. The second part of Carl-Erik's question is, my lactate heart rate in running is 173 beats per minute. so I feel that my heart rate on the bike is surprisingly low. Is this a problem? If it is, what can I do about it? I'm thinking of adding a couple of 15-minute intervals in the upper end of zone 2 or lower end of zone 3, but feel that this might be counter to the actual purpose of the ride and might actually be detrimental. Okay, so the premise of the question here is that lactate threshold heart rate for running is relatively high, or especially compared to like the relatively low heart rate Karl-Erik experiences in his zone 2 riding. So remember, for the first 2 hours or so of his ride, at 190 watts, he's averaging 105 to 115 beats per minute. So compared to a running lactate threshold heart rate of 173, that seems low. Is this a problem? So my answer here is that I don't like the metric lactate threshold heart rate, neither on the run nor any other sport, unless you've actually done a proper lactate test, a proper step test. But even then, it depends on what test protocol you used, who did the test, how did they interpret the results. So I would rather put any heart rate relative to your maximum heart rate always in the specific discipline. So your maximum heart rate in running is different than in cycling. But basically, if you do any all-out test on the bike between 5 to 20 minutes, you can expect that the highest heart rate that you reach in that test is your maximum heart rate on the bike, or close enough. It's going to be within a couple of beats per minute. It is very normal that maximum heart rate on the bike is about 5 beats per minute lower than on the run in well-rounded triathletes that are equally strong on the run and the bike. But for somebody who is a lot stronger on the run than on the bike, which I think you would fall into that category, even though your bike is quite strong, so maybe not, but you could fall in that category with your running background, this difference could be more pronounced. So it's not uncommon at all to see a 10 beat per minute difference for somebody of that profile, a strong runner, but slightly or newer cyclist. This does not always have to be the case, but it could be. So we could do some back of the napkin math. And if we assume that your like lactate threshold heart rate that you say is 173, if we assume that this is correct, lactate threshold heart rate varies as a percentage of maximum heart rate, but I tend to use like 90% as an estimate. If I know maximum heart rate of an athlete, I haven't done a lactate test with them, then I would estimate that their LT2 is at 90% or maybe, 90% of their maximum heart rate. So that means that your maximum heart rate for running would be 192 beats per minute. And then if we assume that your maximum heart rate for biking is 10 beats per minute lower, that is 182 beats per minute. This means that when you start your bike rides, if let's say we take 110 beats per minute, that's your first 2 hour heart rate, and your last hour heart rate is 130 beats per minute. Those are the numbers in the middle of the ranges you mentioned. That means that you start in the first 2 hours, you're at 60% of max, and the last hour you're at 72% of max. And to put that in perspective, when I set heart rate zones, I would use 70% of max heart rate as the border between zone 1 and zone 2. Again, this is if I don't have a lactate test or a step test, I just have maximum heart rate data to go by, which, to be honest, is most of the time with most athletes. That's how I set heart rate zones. So you would start in your heart rate zone 1 there, where you're actually well below zone 2 with 60%, and then you finish in the low end of heart rate zone 2. And again, this is perfectly normal and expected for somebody with your running background. Your cardiovascular system is very well developed, but you haven't had as much time to have the specific muscular and cellular adaptations for cycling. So basically what happens, physiologically speaking, is that your working muscles for cycling cannot create enough demand for oxygen compared to the supply of oxygen that you get easily from your heart to the muscles. So that means that your heart can chill and work at a very low percent of maximum because your muscles are not demanding as much oxygen. They're just, for them to work at what right now is zone 2 for you, the amount of oxygen is relatively low compared to what your heart is capable of pumping out to your body. So again, you don't need to change anything for this reason. You shouldn't chase a higher heart rate because you're not limited cardiovascularly. You're limited more muscularly and cellularly. Basically, all that means is that you have to keep working on working on your volume, but working on different types of intervals and be consistent over time. Again, so the answer is not different than the question before. This is very normal for somebody with your profile. However, one thing you could experiment with, and this comes back to the previous question that we had from Everett, is cadence. So specifically higher cadence. You might find that heart rate goes up for the same power if you increase your cadence. And it could be something that you use in some rides. It doesn't have to be. But especially if your cadence on the bike is pretty low, then that's something to think about. For example, if your comfortable cadence right now is 70 RPM, then trying to push that up, gradually getting closer to 80, would be a desired long-term adaptation, I would say anyway. And this would also probably smooth out a little bit of that discrepancy between oxygen supply and demand that is the reason for your lower heart rate. But to be very clear, cadence is only a pretty small factor here, I would say. And the big factor is just that for the muscular adaptations to your cycling muscles, the prime movers for cycling to take place, you just need time. It's simple as that. So I hope that this helps, and good luck with your training. I hope that you enjoyed that Q&A episode. Thank you again to everybody who is sending in all these great questions. And as a heads up, if you're interested in sending in questions, I know that I'm not doing these Q&As exactly on a weekly basis, so it can take a bit of time to get it answered on the podcast. But I actually always try to give a short answer over email pretty quickly when people send in questions over email. So you can get the gist of the answer and then a more detailed answer later on the podcast. But I've for now, at least I've always been able to give everybody who is emailing in questions an answer that might be short and concise, but it should still be quite helpful then and there. So don't let the time between Q&A episodes be a deterrent from sending in questions. I do love getting them, and I really appreciate the interaction with all of you listeners. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. I don't know if we'll have any links in this episode, but if I think of something, I'll put it in there. Next episode, I have another interview. It will be Coach John Davis, who is a running coach, and he has a really great website and great resources on runningridings.com. And this has been a really good resource for me to read from, and I recommend you give it a look. It's been a while since we've done a running specific episode. It feels like I might be misremembering, but that's what it feels like. So I'm really excited for this one. I haven't conducted the interview yet at the moment of recording this, but I'm confident it will be a good one. And just a reminder of a bit of promotion for Scientific Triathlon and what we do. If you need help with your training, then check out our options for coaching, training plans, and consultations on scientifictriathlon.com. Like I said in the first question that we had today, 99% of people will need a coach if you really want to get the most out of yourself. So this is by far the best option if you are a dedicated athlete and you are able to invest in yourself in this way. I know, however, that not everyone can or want to invest that much in coaching. So we have other options at different price points that are also very effective, from ready-made training plans to one-off consultations and fully customized training plans. Have a look at all of this on scientifictriathlon.com. And if you have any questions, please email me, michael@scientifictriathlon.com, if you're interested in any of what we have to offer and if you have any questions about that. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS25. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.